Normally, our Talking Bookshelf series is where we have a couple of people come in to talk about a book that's been written by somebody else. So it's a great pleasure to have J. Paul Henderson with us because he can talk about his own book. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Now, your book is called The Last of the Bowmans, although that's not your first novel. It's the one that we're talking about
that's
today.
That's the second novel.
There are certain reflections on your life in there, so let's just have a look at your life first. You were born and bred in Bradford in Yorkshire?
That's right.
And then?
Then I was away from there for maybe 10 years and was going to universities and ended up in Mississippi for four of those years.
What did you go to study?
It's a 20th century U.S. history. I was working on a doctorate.
Okay, so American Literature Institute American History.
Yeah.
Were you an undergraduate in this country first?
Undergraduate and did a master's in American Studies at Southampton University. Okay. But that was a 12-month degree. And then, but after I'd done the I spent 8 years doing history, but then just finding a job relating to history, and there weren't any, so I ended up in academic publishing.
In the UK?
In the UK, yes.
Right. At what point did you think you wanted to be a writer?
I played with words since maybe 20, but mainly lyrics and short articles. And I always thought I'd like to write a book, but, you know, it's one thing thinking about it, and there's another thing, you know, doing it. And it just seemed sensible to wait till I'd, you know, kind of finished with work. And then, you know, I could just kind of settle down and just do it as and when. And that's what happened. And as it turned out, I'd only got the idea for the first book maybe 2 years before I retired. So it just worked out nicely there.
When you left the UK, I'm wondering if you were leaving behind a dysfunctional family, because that's what your book is based on.
It is, but no, my family was, very straight. It was there's no real dysfunction in it, but it's the imagination that the book is based on, even though I've set it in a place that I grew up in.
Okay, tell us a little bit about the book. Maybe you've got something at the front end of the book that we could listen to first. Can you read us something from the beginning?
Well, the prologue, which sets up the book itself, is the death of the family's patriarch when he accidentally drinks some white spirit instead of taking the antibiotics that he was presuming. Lyle Bowman was an old man with a sweet tooth, though which of his 12 remaining teeth the adage referred to is unknown. He was in the downstairs hallway, painting an area of skirting board when the day's sugar craving hit. Immediately he walked to the kitchen and placed his paintbrush in a jar of white spirit, wiped his hands on a damp cloth and pulled on his jacket. What he needed, he decided, was a Cadbury's Double Decker. He was about to leave the house when he remembered the sachet of antibiotics he dissolved in water that morning and forgot to drink. His dentist, Mr. Bloom, had insisted on him completing a 3-day course of the drug before extracting yet another of his teeth that had loosened in the gum. Teeth, Lyle sighed, and downed the liquid in one. He was prepared for the unpleasantness of the taste, but was surprised by the heat of the liquid as it passed down his throat. He grimaced the same way he did after swallowing a tablespoon of cod liver oil and reached in his pocket for a peppermint. Blooming dentist, Lyle sighed. Lyle locked the front door behind him and walked to the garden path. He saw Mrs. Turton standing at the next door window and waved to her. She waved back and smiled. He fumbled with the catch on the wrought iron gate and set off for the local shops. Lyle Bowman had never once in his life been drunk and was therefore incapable of recognising the telltale signs of inebriation. A glass of sherry on Christmas Day and the occasional half pint of beer during the year had made for a lifetime consumption of probably no more than 250 units. Consequently, he placed the feeling of lightheadedness and his increasingly unsteady gait at the feet of the magnolia paint fumes he'd been breathing and reminded himself to open the window when he returned home. He entered the shop and made his way uncertainly to the shelves where the confectionery was displayed. Eventually, he found the double-decker he was looking for and took it to the checkout. There, he faffed in his trouser pocket for a pound coin and at last placed it on the counter. "That's 72p," the assistant said. 72p, Lyle slurred, "that they're only 57p across the road. That makes your price..." He struggled to calculate the exact price difference and was reduced to ending his sentence on a less emphatic note. A lot more expensive. "I just work here, mate. I don't set the prices," the assistant shrugged. "Now, do you want the double-decker or don't you?" "I don't," Lyle said, a little more aggressively than he usually spoke to people. "I'm taking my business across the road." It was a bad decision. Rather than walk to the zebra crossing, Lyle took the more direct route, or at least it would have been more direct if he hadn't traversed it diagonally and crossed the road at a bend where motorists and pedestrians are blind to each other. It was here that Lyle Bowman made his fateful acquaintance with a bus. A small crowd gathered and stood around his moving body, keeping him company while the ambulance arrived. I think he's trying to say something, one of the bystanders said. A man in his 20s knelt down by Lyle's side. Double-decker, Lyle sighed softly. No, it was a single-decker, the young man replied helpfully. One of those small buses. Lyle Bowman died in the ambulance on his way to hospital. He was 83 years old.
Apart from the language that you use there, there's also that there's one other thing that we, the reader, sort of know, we dread, we fear what's going to come. Is that something you structured? Or does that just come out?
You knew something bad was probably going to happen as Lyle progresses, but I just wanted his denouement to be at the same time sad, but at the same time quite amusing.
So it's a sort. I mean, we're getting into black comedy here.
It is black humour, and I've never really considered my humour to be black. I just thought it was regular humour, but it's not, as it turns out. But I just like inappropriate humour or humour that comes out when it's least expected. Mm. And so sometimes that does go on the dark side.
Now, what happens next is that there's, of course, going to be a funeral as a result
yes.
of this.
Yeah.
And this is where you start to bring in the members of the family.
That's right.
And the neighbours
yes.
from hell.
Yes, everybody who turns up in the book for the rest of it and starts in the funeral.
Where do you get these characters from?
Primary imagination. I had an uncle called Frank, and he was small and quite deaf, but that's as far as it went. And then he just kind of made these people into more grotesque versions of themselves, and he wouldn't have recognised himself as Uncle Frank, and he isn't Uncle Frank. But it's just a germ of an idea that you can work from that. But it's essentially, yeah, they're just kind of people that cropped up in my head.
Do you listen to people as you go around? Do you catch? I mean, this is one of the great. Alan Bennett is always supposed to be out there listening to anybody who talked on the bus, as it were. A lot of his
I'm not. Sometimes you do hear things, but I don't purposely go looking to hear other people.
Okay. So you're creating characters, and you're creating this matrix of characters that both rely upon each other and conflict with each other, and
yes.
depend for their development on each other.
Yes,
you just pursue those to their logic. Do you let them go?
You pursue them to the logic or even illogic. You'll start up with a character and you only kind of really get to know him. Maybe by the time you got to chapter 2, chapter 3, then you might have to kind of tweak a few things you've written before. But yeah, the people do become real people when you're writing to them. When you finish the book, it's as if you've just suffered deaths of your own. It's disappeared now, and you've got to start again.
The trick, if you like, in the book is that you establish these characters, and there are two brothers, and one has come back from America, and this is where I asked you where
yes.
your own experience, as it were. So he's coming back from America with that context in his mind, and you were able to feed into that from your own experience. And then the other relatives, we go through the funeral and the vicar and all the characters. But then something happens in relation to the father. The father reappears.
Yes, that's why it's not so sad when Lyle, the father, dies on the second page, because he does reappear in a slightly ethereal form. After a bad experience of a bad customer service experience in the afterlife, and so he gets a 20-day furlough, and he appears to Greg, the son, who is usually the son of last resort, the son that people don't rely on, and charges him with fixing the family, because it turns out that his brother Billy has issues, and so does his uncle Frank, and so for the first time in his life, Greg has got to take on the mantle of responsibility, and hates every minute of it. But he sees it through to the end.
Where did that idea come from, that the reappearance of a...
It was after the father had died, it was just a means of getting the story to motor on rather than go flashbacks the whole time. Mm. If you had the father that came back to life, and there can be joy and humour in that. And it was also, it was a chance for Greg, and probably himself included, to have conversations with a parent that you never had in your life, that you always wish you had. And he gets the second bite of the cherry for that. And so I think he's sadder the second time his father dies or disappears than when he heard the news when he was in the States.
Because the relationships are, as you said, dysfunctional. I mean, between the
yes.
brothers, between the brother and the sister-in-law, between the uncle and the...
Yes,
And is he coming to solve all these? Is there a hidden message behind this? Like there is?
Well, no, Greg ideally would just like to go to a funeral, then, sell the house and go straight back to America again. And he becomes involved in the issues of the family against his better judgment. But it's just the idea that maybe families ought to talk more to each other and not maybe have the secrets that they often do.
So there is a message behind this. It's not just humour.
I wasn't thinking I must write a book with a message. It was just the humour that interested me. But it's also one of the morals to it. It's something people don't talk enough to each other about things that they keep bottled up.
You use quite a few specific details. I mean, in that opening piece, you talked about the double decker, and it took me a moment to think, what on earth is it? Oh, no, I remembered it. It's a chocolate.
Yeah. Chocolate. Well, that was just a phase. I went through a phase. I used to Kit Kat Chunky. I used to think that was a fantastic chocolate bar. And then I moved on to Cadbury's double decker. And it was just like you could buy them, but, you know, some shops it would be, say, 72p, other shops, 57p. You could never quite understand the rationale of that. And then when you got the double decker and then the single decker, then you could, you know, make it into a nice little ending.
That's right. There's another place where you bring in details. There's something about the jam. The gollywogs on the jam, isn't there?
Mrs. Turton, who is the next door neighbour of the father and where Greg and Billy grew up, her son Barry, who Lyle's convinced has a Nazi uniform hanging up in his wardrobe somewhere, believes that the UK should celebrate those immigrants that have made an effort to fit in. And he quotes Lenny Henry as being such a person, even though, as Greg points out, Mrs. Turton, who was actually born in this country, is from Jamaica rather than on the...
Give us read us a section from the book about this.
Okay. Okay, this is where Mrs. Turton and Greg have been talking about the people that she refers to as the newcomers, the immigrants to the city. Mrs. Turton nodded. You can't blame people for feeling the way they do, Gregory, and I certainly didn't blame your father. If they'd tried to fit in more and become more westernised, I don't think there'd ever been a problem. But very few of them have done. That's why Barry says we should celebrate those that have, people like Lenny Henry. Lenny Henry's British, Greg said, and his parents were from Jamaica, not Pakistan. Yes, but you know what I mean, Gregory. He's fitted in, hasn't he? And he's always got that nice smile on his face. If I'm honest, though, I can't say that I find him particularly funny. I watched him on television the other week, and I didn't laugh once. I wouldn't have bothered, but the Radio Times gave him a good write-up and described him as a comic genius. Well, I think that was stretching it a bit. They probably only said that because his show was on BBC One. I mean, he looks like he should be funny, doesn't he? But he's not. Or at least I don't think he is. Barry likes him, though, and he's forever shouting out Katanga. That's one of his catchphrases. Now, what the dickens are the names of those other two characters of his that Barry goes on about? Mrs. Turton studied for a moment and then announced the names triumphantly. Delbert Wilkins and Theophilus P. Wildebeest. Barry says they're funnier than Mr. Pastry. Greg glanced at his watch. I'm not sure I agree with him there, though, Mrs. Turton continued. In my opinion, Mr. Pastry was a lot funnier. But Barry's a lot more forgiving than I am, believe it or not, and he always looks for the positives in people. He'll find something good to say about anyone, even Robert Kilroy Silk. He doesn't like the man's politics, they're a bit too left-wing for Barry, but he does give him credit for having tidy hair. And Barry says that even if I don't find Lenny Henry funny, I should still give him his due for the works he does in Africa for Comic Relief and his Premier Inn adverts. And the fact that he was a trailblazer for other black comedians, I suppose, Greg said. I'm sorry, Gregory, I don't allow words like that in this house. What words? You know very well what I'm talking about. Words like B-L-A-C-K, she said, spelling out the letters. It's racist. But he is black, Mrs. Turton, and what's more, he's probably proud of being black. Black's a positive word, just like white. It's not being racist to say a person's black. I think we'll have to disagree on that, Gregory, but while you're in my house, I'd appreciate it if you don't use that word. Anyway, going back to what I was saying, Barry says that we should celebrate newcomers who make an effort to fit in, and he wrote to the company that makes Robertson's Golden Shred to try and get them to back one of his ideas. He said that now they've stopped putting paper gollywogs behind the labels, maybe they should consider putting photographs of people like Lenny Henry and Moira Stewart there. Barry was upset as anybody when Moira lost her job for being too old. She wasn't even pension age. And what did Robertson's have to say about this? Greg asked, incredulous that Barry could be so blind to the mores of the time. To tell you the truth, I don't think they took him seriously, Mrs. Turton said. They just wrote back thanking him for his interest in Golden Shred and asked him if he'd tried any Hartley's jam recently.
It's a book that's based, not say largely, but there's a lot of conversation in it. There's a lot of dialogue, isn't there, between the characters. And it's through that you establish your characters. There isn't a narrator. I mean, Greg is a sort of means to access all this, isn't he?
Yes.
He's your stand-in narrator, as it were.
He's, I suppose, if, what's going on through Greg's mind is an explanation of what goes on in the story itself. But it is. It's the dialogue that allows the characters to reveal themselves.
Well, we can't give too much away. That's the problem. So we mustn't talk too much about it. You have a previous book, the name of which is The Last Bus to Coffeeville. Now, that sounds like that was written while you were in the States. But
No, it wasn't. I wrote that after I'd retired. But again, it draws on certainly the time I spent in Mississippi, but it also draws on my mother had dementia for the last 10 years of her life, and it was just seeing her disappear during that time that you started to wonder if somebody actually knew they were going to die so awfully, you know, would they take measures to sidestep the misery? And so that was the idea behind The Last Bus. But because I mean, there's not a lot of cheer in dementia or assisted suicide, and so I decided to put in a setting of competing dislocations where you could bring other characters in where humour could be made from their plights, in inverted commas. And yes, also putting in, yeah, in the context that bad things happen throughout life, not just towards its end. And there's a possibility to overcome these things.
Okay, so although it's very difficult not to consider this slightly black humour, because here you are again with dementia, with end of life, with various problems associated with that. And yet you find optimism.
Yes, I think it is an optimistic book. I think it's a book about friendship and the bonds that people have for one another. And with the humour, there's no humour at the expense of the Alzheimer's in the book. You know, I don't think that would have been appropriate. But the humour surrounds the other stories in the book, and that's where allows me to get through the writing. Just if you were writing about Alzheimer's for, 300 pages or so, I think I'd end up depressed.
One can't help thinking of, I mean, other books that we've discussed on our series, the 100-year-old man who climbed out the window and disappeared. That was completely different, but it was, again, about old age. The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry is, again, a man in his old age, almost stepping out to try and do something before it's too late. Do you think there's a trend now in writing that we've got a lot of books about old age because there are so many of us in that bracket?
It could well be. And, you know, the idea that life stops just because you reach 60 or 65 or whatever. It doesn't. It continues, and I think, you know, the stories of older people are just in the context of younger people in the stories as well. And I think, yeah, I think it's very valid.
What happens next? What do you write next?
The one I just finished was that one is set in the States this time in the Georgetown area of Washington D.C. And that if they stick with the title I got for it, that's called Larry and the Dog People. And again, that's about a. Again, I suppose that's going to be the kind of black humour area. I mean, it's just a man, just cut it briefly, because otherwise if I explain it, it always sounds ridiculous. But it's about a man who, you know, buys a dog and ends up in prison. And that's it. And he's old. He's old as well.
Well, I hope we live long enough to see it published in this country.
Well, I do too, yes.
When I say we, I mean me. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being invited.